This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. This afternoon, computers in you on the Afternoon Magazine. We invite your phone calls for the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for Faculty and Staff Technology Training at the University of Illinois. Peter Kimball is our guest. Faculty and Staff Technology Training is also known as FAST 3. The program's been around for 3 years. Each year, some 2,000 people take advantage of its workshops. Prior to his work with FAST 3, Peter Kimball taught computer science at junior college and at the junior-senior high school levels. Peter Kimball earned a bachelor's degree in psychology from the University of Illinois. He also holds the degree of MSTCS, a Master's of Science in the Teaching of Computer Science. Your questions about computers are welcome this afternoon. Hardware, software, the web. Give us a telephone call. Talk to Peter Kimball. In Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else you're listening, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Peter Kimball, good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's talk a little bit maybe about COMDEX. This is the world's biggest computer trade show. It's been underway this week in Las Vegas. Some 200,000 people in the industry attend. And this year there was a lot of buzz about what they're calling information appliances.
Well, that's certainly true. We've heard about the Internet reaching into the home for several years now. But all of a sudden, especially with the advent of high-speed connections to the Internet and even cheaper chips and devices that can be built into appliances, it's become possible to have more communication, not just with the Internet and your computer, but with your television set, with your stereo, perhaps getting your music from the Internet. I think it's probably a little way from having your refrigerator and your toaster oven connected to the Internet. Those are sometimes given as extreme examples. But certainly the whole landscape is going to change amazingly in the next 3 or 4 years. Who would have thought 5 years ago that the Internet would have been as large and the World Wide Web as large as it is now? It was mostly the domain of university researchers and government officials.
Yeah. Well, let's back up a little bit. And for those of us who are trying to, we're barely keeping up with this technology and trying to keep abreast of what all these things mean, just what is an information appliance?
Well, the short answer would be anything that can pass on information about its own status, such as is the network broadcasting a particular program that you wish at a particular time, have the information sent to the VCR to record it automatically? Is it necessary to have the latest version of a particular artist album? You could have that downloaded automatically. To take it a little bit further, you might find, and this is a lot of this is in the proof of concept stage, you could have your refrigerator, were it to fail, the compressor to fail, it could send an alert out saying, I've got a problem, my temperature is going up. Instead of coming home and finding melted ice cream all over the floor, you could get an alert which could be directed to you at your PC at work, to your little handheld cell phone, which has a web interface.
So would it be correct also to call a cell phone and a Palm Pilot and those kinds of things information appliances?
Well, they certainly are in the broadest sense of the term, anything that allows you to communicate information one way or the other. Usually a cell phone by itself wouldn't be thought of as that much of an Internet appliance, but many of them now have screens that can actually give you, through your cell phone connection, access to email, access to a very small screen version of a web browser. So you could check your stock prices, you could check on messages that you'd received, you could check on the weather report without actually having to dial a recording that's available on the web.
Yeah. Do you think there'll come a time when this technology will kind of, we won't have to rewrite rethink the workshop catalog for FAST 3?
Well, not anytime soon. One of the things that's happening is more and more capabilities are being realized as the price of computing power becomes less and less. One of the things that's beyond the horizon, or it's no longer beyond the horizon, it's now actually approaching rapidly, is speech recognition with more accuracy than has been possible in the last 2 or 3 years. So the time of the Star Trek type computers where you just talk to it and it understands what you're saying, not only is getting here rapidly, there was just a report within the last week of a device that is more precise in picking out human speech from a large background of noise than the human ear is and doing it accurately. There are even translator devices now that can take speech and translate it into one of 5 or 6 languages fairly accurately. And that processing power is just going to become more and more prevalent throughout all kinds of appliances. So the time of having to use a keyboard or the time of having to use a mouse may well be coming to the point that voice supplants most of that. Mm-hmm. So as long as that's happening, there's going to be more and more uses thought of that were just not practical or affordable before.
Yeah, everything will be hopefully easier to use, hopefully cheaper. Smaller, I suppose, as well.
Quite a bit smaller. There's some concern about if your appliances are reporting their status, if your TV is monitoring airwaves and recording your favorites. What about privacy? Because all of this is being sent back and forth. There was a major little blow-up not more than a couple of weeks ago when it was announced or discovered that a very popular software program that allows you to play CDs, either your own or downloaded from the network, would tell you, because of the internet connection, if you've put in your own audio CD, what the author is, what the track is, all that's available in the database. But unbeknownst to the consumer, that information was also being sent to the company that provided that software product, and they, and I believe them, said that they were just using it in the aggregate to track consumer preferences and tastes. But it's a little bit scary to think about your preferences in music every time you put in a CD into your computer system. The fact that you're listening to that particular cut or that particular artist is now part of somebody's database.
Yeah. Well, also there's been some discussion recently about, you know, when you're on the web and you go to different sites, your preferences are being noted, and the advertising that comes up on web pages is tailored to what your interests have been, what you've hit on the web.
That's also an increasing concern. Many websites have now actually subscribed to a privacy policy. They will, you'll find, and actually if you're going to be entering information into a web form on one of these sites, you should look for their privacy statement. What are they going to do with the information? Until fairly recently, once you've given them the information, it's no longer considered to be yours. It can be sold to any other company, and many of those companies will pay a fairly substantial price to know just who it is who was looking at books that dealt with a particular medical condition, for example, because then they could target you for your insurance, they could target you for various other kinds of products.
Wow.
But those privacy statements are now starting to become much more prevalent on the web, in large part because a lot of the online merchants and others want to head off government regulation by self-regulating. And as aware consumers, everyone should probably make a point of looking up, not every website that you go to, it doesn't really matter if you're just surfing it, but as soon as you have one of these forms that you're going to be submitting information, not only think about just what information are you sending them, but try to look and see what they're going to do with it.
This is our monthly discussion of about computers here on the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Peter Kimball. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to talk with us, your questions are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Anywhere else you're listening, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. WILL. Well, I guess cable is coming to as a way to access the web, to have your internet service provided. What's around the corner here for us in Champaign-Urbana?
Well, literally just around the corner, within a couple of weeks or so, cable modems are going to become available, and cable delivery of internet services. Now, that means the same cables that you use for your cable television connection. In Champaign-Urbana, it's AT&T. And the biggest problem many people have discovered working with web pages and trying to get information over the web is if you're dialing in from home with a modem, even the fastest modems are relatively slow. It's particularly noticeable for folks who have, such as at the university or other company locations, very fast internet access. All of a sudden, the information that was easily accessible to you with a very fast connection is painfully slow, almost to the point of unusability, if you have to dial in and transfer a file that's going to take 15 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour or two. With cable modems, with the actual connection to the internet via the cable, and that's only one of about three different ways that you can get high-speed access, all of a sudden you're not limited to those dial-up speeds. You have speeds that in practice may be 100 times faster. There are some claims of 1,000 times faster, but those are mostly marketing hyperbole. However, it is so much faster than normal dial-up access that waiting for large files, being able to actively surf a number of sites trying to find the information you're looking for becomes much more practical. Unfortunately, there are also some security concerns there as well, because the tendency for people who start using cable modems and other kinds of connections is to leave your computer on all the time. There's no longer a need to dial up. There's no dial tone that you have to wait for. And as soon as your computer is on all the time, it's visible to others on the internet who may be looking for computers that aren't as well protected as they should be. So that goes hand in hand with having the kind of permanent access.
Yeah. Is there a way to get around that problem, or that worry?
There's going to be. There are a few ways now. Most of the major computer manufacturers and software manufacturers, including, of course, Microsoft, one of the largest, has promised that built into future versions of the operating system and the applications will be what are loosely called firewalls. It's a protective layer between you and the internet. That's not here just yet as a built-in feature, but there are a number of products, some of them simply software, try it for 15 days, buy it for $30 or $40, that can protect you from the most common sorts of attacks. There are also little hardware devices. Large companies typically have $10,000 or $15,000 machines that examine every bit of traffic that goes in and out, not to pry into the content, but to make sure it's coming from an authorized user and to make sure that it is not attempting to circumvent some of the known security weaknesses in various computer systems. That's not practical or necessary at home, but something should be done.
Yeah. In the meantime, would it be practical at all to unconnect the hardware?
Well, certainly at the time, if you're not actively serving pages,
yeah.
If you don't need to maintain a permanent connection, mm-hmm. if your computer's off or if it's disconnected from the network, there's certainly no way anybody's going to make connection or cause any damage or mischief. But most people are going to tend to want to have the convenience of leaving it on, sit down, click, and there it is, rather than having to power up the computer or plug in the modem or something. So it's going to be a matter of convenience for most people to just leave it on. Although, of course, the security is less. I don't see any need that somebody would want to have their machine left on 24 hours a day.
No.
But a lot of machines are left on, even here on campus.
Yeah. What kind of hardware is needed for cable access?
Well, the major piece is simply a special kind of modem that communicates in between, that just like a regular dial-up modem. It's called a cable modem. I'm not quite sure what the local pricing is going to be, but typically it's about $200. That's a one-time expense. The cable modem connects to your computer through the same kind of network card that computers and businesses use. Those are relatively inexpensive, and most machines sold today actually have them built in. It's called Ethernet. And then the only other cost, besides those startup costs, is what you pay to the cable company for the service, and I believe it's going to start right around $39, $40 a month here in the Champaign-Urbana area.
Will there be any competition among cable companies in a local market, in any given market?
Well, that's a very good question, and there are a lot of legal maneuverings taking place. Should the cable company be required to share its cable lines with other internet service providers. The same thing is true for the telephone company. They have copper wires running to practically every house. Those copper wires can use another kind of fast connection called a DSL or digital subscriber line. And there are several court cases pending as to whether the local phone companies should be forced to make those lines available to other competitors. At this point, it's not quite clear what's going to happen. We do have in Champaign-Urbana another phone company in addition to Ameritech SBC, and that's McLeod Communications, and so we probably are in a better position here for some competition down the road. McLeod is laying lots of fiber throughout the Champaign-Urbana area with the idea, one presumes, of not only being a telecommunications provider but also a network and internet access provider.
We have a caller waiting to talk with us. Our first caller this afternoon is on line one in Charleston. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question regarding an employee and their expectation of or right to privacy in the workplace. My employer has recently advised that they have installed a software package that will allow them, if they choose, to monitor activity on my desktop in real time without my knowledge. Has this been challenged in the courts? Do you have any thoughts one way or the other? And I'll just hang up and listen to your response.
Well, it's a very touchy issue, as you can imagine. And yes, there have been, at least in terms of email, a number of court decisions that have said since the employer is supplying you with the connection and with the computers and with the email service, that they have the right to examine that email. It is not your own private property. It seems that it should be, but it's not nearly as private as slipping something into an envelope and putting a first-class stamp on it. In terms of the actual monitoring of what's going on the desktop, this has been an issue, especially with a number of firms, airline reservation firms and such, where, although admittedly this is a specialized application, they actually clock the number of key presses per minute and the amount of time it takes on each phone call, because that's all considered to be legitimate interest of the company to track employee productivity. So you're not going to want to hear this, but in general, the case law is tending to be that, yes, your employer can do that because, A, you're working for them, B, they're supplying the equipment, they're supplying the connection, and they're hiring you for your time there. I wish I had a better answer, and clearly more enlightened employers are going to try to strike a balance between personal privacy and corporate needs. But it's going to be a hot issue.
Yeah. Do you think at this point it's prudent for an employer to provide a policy that applies to everyone in the workplace on these issues, and or for prudent for an employee to ask about such a policy?
Very definitely. The employer probably could avoid any lawsuits simply because of the precedents that have been set, but the employer will certainly be in a much stronger position if they have publicized this, and many actually do now. They will say your email is not private. We've seen a number of cases in the news in recent years where email that, even once it's been deleted by the recipient, have discovered in some cases, much to their chagrin, that there are backup copies of all of that available. The big Microsoft and Justice Department court case is using a lot of email that was 2 or 3 or 4 years old. And in terms of government, there are a lot of email messages that are there. So the net result is a general rule of thumb that one frequently hears for employees who definitely should ask about the policy, if nothing else than to get the company to promulgate one, is don't write anything in email that you don't want to see on page one of the paper.
We've got a couple of other callers waiting for us this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, and I'm going to give our guest another set of headphones, because I think that you've got a bad plug there, so we'll get this fixed up here momentarily. Our guest this afternoon is Peter Kimball. He's with the program at the University of Illinois known as FAST 3, Faculty and Staff Technology Training. He's the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for FAST 3. Our next caller this afternoon is on line 2 in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi, I've got a question about MP3 distortion. I've got a PC that's just ungodly powerful with 550 Pentium chip and 256 megs of RAM, but every time I play an MP3 through Winamp or Music Match or anything like that, it skips and jumps around like crazy, even when I'm not doing anything that should be causing it to react that way. I can do as little as open a folder or get some email, and it will all but cause the MP3 player to crash. And our local computer guy says he suspects it's some kind of memory corruption, but he doesn't know what to do about it.
Well, I can give a shot at that.
Okay.
Is it running on a Windows platform,
yes,
would you say?
Yes, Windows 98.
Okay. The problem with many of these programs, and let me assume that you've also downloaded the most recent
yes,
players. Are you using the RealPlayer G2s? Make sure you've got the most recent version of the drivers.
Okay.
Do realize, although I know that your problems are more severe than this, that you're never going to get the same quality from an MP3 download as you
I
are
know.
From a CD audio. Because
my last machine, which was much less powerful, only had 64 megs of RAM and maybe a 200 chip, played my MP3s almost flawlessly no matter what I tried to do. But something about this machine is causing it to have lots of trouble no matter what happens.
Well, the best I could suggest without more detailed diagnosis would be to certainly look at the software drivers, the device drivers for your multimedia.
For the sound card.
Because that's at the most fundamental level. And if there's some sort of conflict there where it's being interrupted by other processes in the computer, if the actual software driver is not configured quite properly, sometimes you get new machines from Dell or Gateway or Compaq that may not be perfectly configured.
Mm-hmm. So now, if the sound card driver was faulty, would that also cause regular audio CDs to have problems too?
Possible, although not necessarily, because those are different sets of functions. You're simply playing back the audio CDs, a different kind of sound stream than is coming in from the MP3.
Yeah, I only have trouble when playing MP3.
Yeah.
Our software guy also said it might be due to some kind of conflict with the various kinds of software that I use every day.
One of the things you're saying the problem happens even when you aren't running any other software.
With all it takes is for the screensaver to come up, and whatever music I'm listening to will get very distorted. So I could be running nothing. And I don't know if it's Windows itself or something internal, like you said, maybe the sound card driver. I don't know.
I would check the sound card. I would check for conflicts with the various device drivers. If you're running Windows 98, that is better than 95 or Windows NT in terms of sound. But the other thing you can try doing is disable your screensaver. See if other things happen besides that. Is it the screensaver itself that is...
No, I was just using it as an example of how little has to take place for the music to stop. Like I said, all I have to do is open a folder, screensaver comes on, I happen to get email. Anything that seems to happen that distracts my computer causes the MP3 player to distort.
It definitely sounds like a conflict at the device driver level, the priority that the machine is giving to the MP3 player is apparently lower than it should be, and all of a sudden something else happens and the cycles are stolen away from that driver. But
I can check the sound card website for the latest drivers, but you said to check for conflicts.
Yes,
how would I do that?
Well, one of the things you'll find when you go to the website of the sound card manufacturer is most likely an area where they talk about troubleshooting, and if this is happening to you, chances are it's happening to others as well.
Okay.
And so the other possibility would be, once you have that sound card identified, many of those websites will give you the opportunity to submit a request or a problem report, and they're usually pretty good at getting back to you.
Okay, well, if it turns out that the sound card is not the problem, do you have any backup ideas to try?
Try the other device drivers that from the control panel. You will find a whole series of devices that are installed, and just run through those and see
Same
what else
process.
Is going on.
Go to the websites
and see
updated.
If you can get yourself updated.
Okay.
Check with the Microsoft website, too. Make sure you've got the most recent version of the software that Microsoft provides. I mean, you've got Windows 98, but make sure. The other thing you might try which would be interesting, would be to download one of the other MP3 players from another company, see if that has a problem. That will certainly isolate it in terms of whether it is low-level or higher-level problem.
Yeah, I've tried 3 or 4 different ones, and they all have the same trouble. And since I didn't have any trouble on my last machine, and I have trouble on this machine, I suspected it was something wrong with my computer.
It sounds like some kind of configuration problem, yes. I'll wish you good luck at it. But
okay. Well, thanks.
Those are tough problems to solve.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Our next caller this afternoon on the toll-free line in Bureau County. Hi.
Good afternoon. You may have already covered this briefly, but I won't be in town when midnight comes on the Y2K and we begin January the 1st of 2000, my computer won't be on. Can anything, if things go on the fritz or any of that stuff does happen, can it affect a computer which is not turned on?
No, you're completely safe as long as that computer is off. You're probably safe anyway. Is it an older computer?
I guess you would say in relative terms it's a in nowadays parlance, it's a Hewlett-Packard, and it's probably 3.5 years old. I use Windows 98, and I usually use Netscape. I don't find that I need Microsoft as well. And I don't do a lot of complex stuff. It's basically email and writing letters and purchasing things, getting on the net, and that kind of stuff. So I didn't know whether I would need to back up my files or not.
Well, backing up files, whether or not it's Y2K, is always a good idea.
Okay.
Murphy's Law would say back up anything that you don't want to lose, because otherwise you're likely to lose it at some point, not necessarily because of Y2K, but even a hard drive crash.
Okay.
The worst thing that is likely to happen is when you do turn your computer on, if it's not Y2 compliant after the first of the year, instead of showing a date of January 2nd or 3rd or whatever it might be, 2000, it might show a date of probably not 1900 on a PC, but it might go to 1980, the earliest date that it can show. That's going to cause some confusion with programs that are dependent upon dates, but it's not going to cause all of your data to be erased. What you can do is you can surf the web. You can go to Hewlett-Packard's website, get the various numbers and model numbers of the machine, and all of the major... This machine is not Y2 compliant because it's 3.5 years old.
Okay.
There's an old rule of thumb that 1 year in a computer's life is like 25 years in a person's life, so your computer's pushing 100 now. And you may well find that there's a very simple remedy. There are other programs that are available for download or for relatively low prices that will check for Y2 compliance. You can do a search at one of the search sites like Yahoo or something for Y2K, and that could give you some additional information.
Okay, well, this has sure been helpful. I've been wondering, and, you know, what I really don't know about my computer would fill probably 6 or 7 volumes. So thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Our next caller on line one, a caller in Muhammad. Hello.
Good afternoon. I have a question about a mouse that it seems like once or twice a day it just stops working. It disappears from the screen. I have no control from the mouse itself. I have to shut off the machine and restart it, reboot it. Any idea what that might be due to?
I've had that happen once or twice on a system that I've had to work with, and it turned out in that case to be a bad cable between the mouse and the place where it plugged in, and when it was bent in a particular way, it would lose connections. The other thing you can do, if in case it's not a hardware problem, and if you've got access to another computer, you can try swapping the mice, and that'll pretty well tell you that.
Well, I did buy a new mouse about a month ago, and I had problems with the first one, thought that was probably a hardwire thing.
Okay.
But I still have the problem with the new one, too.
The new mouse, did it come with the set of software that you installed with it, like little mouse drivers, and you installed that successfully?
Yes.
So that sounds like that's good. The other thing, check to make sure it could still be a bit of a hardware problem. The location where the mouse cord plugs into the computer, that can sometimes be loose or not make a good connection, and that could cause a problem.
Okay. Can I assume that the software for the new mouse erased the software for the first one?
Usually you can assume that, but nothing's certain in the area of upgrades. Software should be written to do that. What you can try doing there's not really a good way of making sure, because the actual software that drives the mouse is scattered in several different locations, and the installation software generally takes care of that. What I would do is double-check the connections. Are you running Windows 95?
Yes.
Okay. You might want to see if there are any updates, depending on which particular machine you're running on. There may be. Is this something that just recently started happening?
No, it's been going on for about 3 months.
But originally it was behaving properly.
That's right.
Well, an interesting problem, because you've replaced the mouse, you've installed the new mouse driver. Unless there were some part of the system software that relates to the mouse that might have had a bit of a problem, and in that case you probably wouldn't have the mouse running at all. I'd almost suspect that it is a connection problem.
Okay, I will check that.
I've occasionally had a keyboard stop responding too, and I just wiggle around and sometimes unplug and plug back in to get rid of some of the corrosion.
You have to hit it a little harder.
You just give it a good thump in the side.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thanks for the call this afternoon. I find that my mouse needs to be dusted every once in a while. It can collect, you know, a little bit of this and a little bit of that in there.
There's a new technology that's available. The old mice, which all have the little mouse ball underneath, can build up all kinds of dust and various other materials, and all of a sudden you move your mouse and it just kind of stops and then jumps. But a new mouse, Microsoft is one of the companies that's producing this, there will be others, have a little optical sensor in it. They actually take about 1,500 snapshots, as it were, of the desktop per second, and it doesn't have any moving parts. And so there's nothing, therefore, to other than the mouse buttons, which you click.
Yeah.
But as you roll it around, it can tell on almost any surface. I suspect it'd have trouble on a mirror. But almost any surface, it can tell that it's being moved, and no longer are there little rollers or little mouse balls to get dust and hair and other debris in.
Yeah.
So that eliminates that problem. I haven't gotten one yet, but I kind of want one every time I have to stop and clean my mouse.
Let's talk with another caller on line 2 in Urbana. Hello.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering, what do you think the impact of internet service on cable arriving here is going to be on local internet service providers?
Good question as well. And initially, it's going to be relatively severe, I suspect, because a lot of the people who are really major internet users are going to jump at the chance of having a much faster connection.
Mm-hmm.
One of the concerns that a number of people have voiced with our local internet cable offering is that so far the only internet service provider that you can choose is AT&T's. You get the cable access, you use AT&T as your internet service provider. A bit problematic for folks who are with the university, because they can no longer use the university as their internet service provider, as most faculty, staff, and students do. There is a lot of discussion, and there may well be some court cases, asking the courts to require AT&T to make available to other ISPs their cable base, so that when you subscribe to the cable modem and the cable internet service, you would then separately, not bundled together, subscribe to your ISP of choice. That hasn't happened yet, but a lot of the industry pundits are hopeful that that kind of model will happen, that you don't have to buy it all in one place. You can pick and choose.
Okay, thank you.
Quite welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. It's the third Thursday of the month, the day we offer a discussion about computers. We call the program Computers and You. This afternoon, Peter Kimball is our guest. He's with the program at the University of Illinois known as FAST 3, Faculty and Staff Technology Training. He's the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for FAST 3. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to join us this afternoon, if you've got a question about computers, give us a call. 333-9455 is the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. We've got one call coming in, but all our other lines are open. While we get that caller lined up, I was I was curious about this. I had seen, going back to the Comdex computer trade show, PCs were not a big highlight of this year's show. And I saw an article, the headline was, "Desktop PCs are the dinosaurs of tech trade show." Do you think we're coming up on a sea change for the personal computer? Do you think we'll head off in a completely different direction?
There's a lot of discussion about that. For example, one of the ideas that's been kicking around for some time now but is becoming a little bit closer to reality is the ability of having not a full-fledged PC at your desktop, but just a good connectivity to the World Wide Web. And Microsoft has even started in a trial version of making some of their applications available for rent. You don't have to buy Microsoft Word. You can rent it and download it as necessary from the web. There's a counter movement, however, that points out that, do you really want to have your documents and your applications on the web subject to what is still somewhat spotty speeds and service? I must get this document printed. Oh, rats, I can't get my word processor downloaded from the web. My web server has no longer got access to that document. They'll be back up in 5 or 10 minutes. The so-called idea of network computers or thin clients, because there's not much locally, has a lot of advantage, especially for notebooks and people moving on the road, but I don't see it replacing the local control of your own documents and your own applications anytime real soon. There's going to be a lot of experimentation in that area. Among other things, it would require fast, reliable, robust connections to the Internet, which is just really starting to happen.
Okay, let's talk with another call. Caller, on line 4, a caller in Chrisman. Good afternoon.
Hi. I've got a 400 megahertz Dell, and I bought it last fall, back when it first came out. And then again this spring, I ended up, I couldn't get hooked onto my Internet connection. And ended up, to make a long story short, they broke my, they took it down to the bare bones and then rebuilt the entire hard drive. And now it's fall and I'm got the same thing again, and they're wanting to break it down to bare hard drive and then rebuild it again. What, am I doing something wrong or am I dealing with the wrong people?
You said this was a 400 megahertz machine that you'd gotten from
Dell.
From Dell. And is it Dell that you're dealing with who are saying we need to rebuild this, or is it?
No, it's a local.
A local. It seems unlikely that breaking the entire, you know, stripping the system down to the bones and reinstalling everything should be necessary twice, unless there's some component in there that's failing regularly. If you bought this new from Dell, and it may not be new if it's because these days the machines are, of course, much faster than 400 megahertz.
No, it's not new anymore.
Okay. Because I was going to inquire about the warranty side of things.
Well, so did my wife.
Yes.
She says, what about a warranty? I said, well, that's history.
Right. The There's something very strange going on here. I don't know that it is necessarily anything that you do. Computers are surprisingly robust, unless you don't drop them or pour Coke into them or something. There really shouldn't be anything that you're doing that is causing a problem. Other than the Internet connectivity, is everything else working on the machine for you?
Oh, yes, yes. No problems on that. I wondered about the things that I downloaded off the net, radio,
real audio player or something.
Yeah,
real
jukebox, real player G2, stuff like that. I was told one time that one fellow told me that I'd added on the Windows 98 update, and he thought that was a bad piece of code.
Well, the problem is there's so much interaction between many of these pieces of code. There was at one point for the RealPlayer G2 some reported problems that it was not compatible with particular configurations. What you might want to try once they get this thing up and running again leave that particular bit of software in case there's something incompatible and download one of the other MP3 players or CD audio players.
Mm-hmm.
There have been some, I can't recall the details now, but I know within the last few months there had been, especially in its initial release, some compatibility problems with RealPlayer G2. You could always download the earlier version from Real. I believe they still make that available on their website.
Yeah, I think I've seen that. But
the problem sometimes is that when you download one of these pieces of software, because it has to put its connections or its hooks into so many different parts of the system, that if there is a problem, it can indeed then cause the whole operating system to not really function as it should.
Okay, well, one time I would have thought it could have been an accident, but two times in a row I felt like there was something going on.
Well, and third time a charm. I probably, until you've got it down, and now when they're rebuilding it, I presume you mean they're essentially just reinstalling Windows and redoing all the software
yeah.
and such?
Mm-hmm.
The third time around, I would, once you get it back, I would go ahead and try another, even though RealPlayer G2 is perhaps the most popular, try another.
That's what I run into everywhere.
Well, that's true, but try limiting your access a little bit to one of the other, like Windows. Microsoft has a new audio video player, and if you're able to do that and it works with no problem, and then the next time you download RealPlayer G2 and it fails again, you pretty well realize that at that point, especially the third time, if not already at the second, that there is some incompatibility between G2 and your particular version of Windows. As far as Windows 98 Second Edition, that was actually supposed to solve a number of problems.
That's why I bought it, yeah.
Yeah.
That's why I bought it, so I thought I was helping.
But you do kind of have a cause and effect relationship going. It works fine. You download G2, it stops working fine. That's suggestive at the very least.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Sure. Good luck to you.
Well, thanks for your call this afternoon, and that about does it for us here this afternoon. We're down here at the end of our time. I guess I could put in one quick question. Fast 3, what kind of workshops do you offer? Give us an idea of what Fast 3 is about.
Well, Fast 3 was first started as a consortium between several campus units, which were all doing training. And we offer both workshops and productivity software for people who need to learn how to use the basic applications, spreadsheets and word processing and databases. My own particular involvement is much more with the kinds of educational technology that might be used to improve instruction or to improve websites, such things as website design using several of the software packages that make it almost like using a word processor to create your own web pages and entire websites. Working with images, since that's a big part of what's going on the web now, programs like Photoshop where you can retouch and manipulate images in any way you may wish. And also, if you're wanting to do presentations, things like PowerPoint and related programs so that you can actually put your ideas and present them to others in a little more effective way than using chalk or a flip chart or something.
Mm. Well, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Quite welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
I hope we'll have you back at some point in the future.
I look forward to it.
Peter Kimball has been our guest. He's with the program at the University of Illinois known as FAST-3, Faculty and Staff Technology Training.